The Church of God the Eternal presents the fifth message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, March 8th, 2025.
Well, we're going to do the fifth message in this new series on the Survey of the Books of Samuel. And we're going to start in 1 Samuel chapter 3. And you say, wait a minute, fifth sermon and you're only through, you know, two chapters. Well, we're going to go faster today. That's my goal. And I plan for this not to be like Mr. Raymond Cole always did for so many years. You hear him on his sermons where he say, we have to move rapidly. And then he only gets through like half his notes for the day. My goal is that we're going to get not only all the way through chapter 3, we're going to get through the majority of chapter 4 today. In other words, I'm trying to make up ground a little bit. I think we can do it. My intent still in covering this, this detailed review of both books of Samuel is literally to give you some meat, some spiritual substance out of all of the things that God chose to record in these storylines. And so I don't want to feel bad about stopping and taking some extra time when appropriate, rather than just trying to speed through it. But I think we're going to get through quite a bit today. So if you remember last time we completed chapter 2, we saw that we emphasized the apostasy that took place under the auspices of Eli the high priest concerning his two sons who he had put in charge of the tabernacle. We saw also God's prophecy that where he literally sent a prophet, unnamed prophet, we don't know who it was, but God literally sent an authorized servant to Eli to give him a prophecy on what was going to happen to him and his family in the future because of his malfeasance in handling his responsibilities as high priest. And so that catches us up now to the beginning of chapter 3. 1 Samuel 3, verse 1, and the child Samuel ministered unto the Eternal before Eli. So we saw before in chapter 1 that in his family turning him over as a very young child, probably 3 to 4 years old, Eli the high priest becomes his guardian. His parents probably see him once a year, might have seen him more if they also came up during the Passover and Pentecost, but minimally the Bible records that they would see him once a year during the Feast of Tabernacles. But he's under the tutelage of Eli the high priest. And here we find it says that the child Samuel ministered unto the Eternal, meaning he was helping with the duties and the responsibilities of the tabernacle. And we read some possible, list of potential job duties that included. And the word of the Eternal was precious in those days. And it doesn't mean that all of the people then were highly committed to the words of God. It really, the emphasis here, precious, is more like costly or in fact rare. Okay, so the word of the Eternal was rare, few and far between. In other words, the number of people who were devoted to truly serving God, pleasing Him, showing obedience and love for God, it was hard to find. It was a costly thing to find a godly person in those days. There was no open vision. And so there was, like in many other times we read in the Bible, where God sends servants with divinely inspired messages from God to whoever the target audience is, whether it's the high priest of the day, whether it's a king, whether it's the nation as a whole. In this day and age, God was not communicating with them. There was a dearth of communication between God and the Israelites, meaning it was a very dark time. And remember, and you say, well, you know, haven't there other times, but God doesn't always do a great work. And that's true. And we'll talk about that momentarily. But understand, remember, during this time, who was the king of Israel? It was God. We're going to see in a few chapters where that changes, and there's for the first time a human king appointed. But up to now, as we've already confirmed, God was the king over Israel. That was an appointment that started from Mount Sinai, from the time that Israel entered into a covenant with him. Okay? God was their king. And so the leaders in the form of judges were simply those who were carrying out the instructions of the king. So remember, Eli was not only high priest, but he was also judge. He was the civic magistrate in charge of the nation, to the extent that they were organized and, you know, acting in a singular fashion. So he wore both titles under God. And yet what this tells us is, but God wasn't communicating with them. In other words, there was a blackout. And what is that like for any nation or organization to operate when the CEO isn't communicating? Meaning that's not a good case. That's not a good situation whatsoever. And why was that? Well, we've already seen, because everything was being totally mismanaged because of the lack of leadership by the high priest to allow all of these abominations going on in the ministry of the religious duties because of Hophni and Phinehas, all right? And Eli was letting it happen. We're going to see more of that today. So in our day, likewise today, I would say it's a time when it's hard, not easy, to find anyone who is faithful to the real revealed truth of God. And there is no great work, quote unquote, being done by God today. Now, we believe we saw a great work being done in the 20th century under the auspices of Mr. Herbert Armstrong in the first 40 years especially. There was a continuing work even after the apostasy began in the early 1970s. But like I've described it as a body that now has cancer and is slowly getting weaker unto death. So, you know, it took from 74 up till past the death of Mr. Armstrong in 1986 before that organization truly died, if you will, in the early 90s. Let's say it took 20 years. But it was a dying organization because of their rejection of the inspiration of God and turning to their own interpretation of doctrine. Okay, so what happened from the time that set in? The ministry of the Worldwide Church of God stopped being inspired by God, meaning he stopped talking to them. He stopped communicating to them. And as a child who grew up during the 70s, I mean, I was not trying to listen to the sermons, but I was affected by the lack of any meat or substance coming from the pulpit. So I'm a witness, and there are others of you who are a witness of the changes that took place. Now, some of you came out with Mr. Cole in 1974 or 1975 or soon after, so maybe you weren't listening to Worldwide Ministers. My family was in until 1981. We heard all the weak, milquetoast sermons that were coming out of the ministry that used to be strongly inspired, and they stopped being inspired. So when I think about, here was a time in Israel's history where, in essence, God stopped communicating with them because they were so apostate and abominable in their behavior and their misbehavior concerning the law that God just blacked them out. That's a dark, dark time. And so we have been living in a very similar time. There are few, not many, who care about the truth. Quickly, a diversion over to Zechariah 4, verse 8. Zechariah 4, here's a prophecy by Zechariah, and he lived during the time of Zerubbabel and the aftermath of the second wave of the Israelites who had been taken into Babylonian captivity, and the second wave who came back into the Holy Land by God's allowance, about 18 years after the first wave with Ezra who came back. And here, Zechariah says, "Moreover, the word of the Eternal came unto me, saying, the hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundations of this house." So now the Israelites are going to try to rebuild the temple, Solomon's temple, that had been absolutely obliterated and destroyed by God's allowance by the Babylonians. His hands, Zerubbabel, shall also finish it. And thou shalt know that the Eternal of hosts has sent me unto you, Zechariah says. He came with the inspiration of God concerning the prophecies of what God is going to do. So in the very day that Zechariah is writing, he's saying, this Zerubbabel literally is going to facilitate the rebuilding of Solomon's temple. And he did. Verse 10, for who hath despised the day of small things? And that's my point for giving, if you think I'm like, what's this have to do with Samuel? Who hath despised the day of small things? Because up until this time, when Zerubbabel was inspired and given the power by God to literally bring about the reconstruction of the temple in Jerusalem, after a 70-year captivity, and then after 18 years of hit and miss attempts to build it, and the first wave of them were not allowed or really permitted by God to do it, and now Zerubbabel comes out of Babylon with the second wave of repatriated Israelites, and now God, and through Zechariah, he's saying, now it's really going to happen because God is backing it up. But up until that time had been a very dark period. And for anybody who wanted to say, well, where is this God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? You know, did he disappear? Did he go on vacation? You can't see him. You can't find him. He's not talking. He's not communicating. He did two key prophets in the day, but to the Israelites as a whole, he wasn't, because of their repudiation of the truth. But here is a prophecy concerning a work that is going to take place. It happened historically. It's also prophetic concerning a last day work that God is going to do. A lot of these ministers and other splinter groups want to call themselves Zerubbabel, like they're going to fulfill this thing to rebuild the temple, or i.e. God's church, and bring everybody back together and make it a big church like it was under Mr. Armstrong in the early years. Good luck to that. They're not doing it. They haven't done it. They've been trying to do it for, you know, 40 years, 30, 40 years. And none of them have done it, and none of them will do it, because they are still repudiating the law. You better start with the truth that God revealed and show respect to that, if you think you're ever going to be a part of a work that God is going to do to restore the church. Yes, he's promised it's going to happen. My point is, even in the same way, the naysayers would have said, this is never going to happen. Rebuild the temple, like in the glory of the days of Solomon. Ha! It's never going to happen. And here God is saying, who hath despised the day of small things? Meaning a period of time when it is dark and it appears that there is no special work being done by God. Never doubt that he is still actively fulfilling his will, even if you can't see it in any outward sense. He is still absolutely working his timetable to accomplish his will, and he's made these prophecies to tell us what he's going to do. I guarantee you, those things are going to come to pass, but it's going to be according to God's timeline, not any man's. Who hath despised the day of small things? For they shall rejoice and shall see the plummet in the hand of Zerubbabel with those seven. They are the eyes of the eternal, which run to and fro throughout the whole earth. Not to get into a bunch of interpretation there, which I wouldn't do a good job of anyway, but saying God is active. He is real. He is working his plan exactly on schedule. And so if we're in a day of small things today, where you see little outwardly happening to fulfill God's promise that he's going to bring his children back, his scattered sheep back out of the wilderness, spiritual wilderness, and bring them back into one fold, like Jesus Christ talks about in John 10. And you say, is that ever going to happen? The answer is yes, because God promised it. In the meantime, he's not, because it's not yet time. When it's time, I guarantee you God is going to do it. And when he sets his hand to do something, very often then it explodes into activity. So we're going to see now, as we go back to 1 Samuel 3, verse 2, an example of one of those times when he begins now to speak to Israel and to do a work, even though that it seems to have been dormant for so many years. Now we're going to see a time where, according to God's will, and it is through the prophet Samuel, that he's going to make these things start to happen. Verse 2, it came to pass that in time, when Eli was laid down in his place and his eyes began to wax dim and he could not see. So here I'm going to talk about speculations on How long was this after Samuel was first given over to Eli's charge at age 3 or 4? We don't know. I'm gonna assume, because this is the first time now that God is literally going to speak to Samuel and inspire Samuel, he has to be an older child. He's not a 4-year-old. He's not a 5-year-old. So the commentators don't agree. God didn't choose to record it. Some say maybe 10 years old. Maybe some say 12. There's a reason I'm going to estimate 11. And it's purely my speculation, but keep that in mind. So I'm thinking about, he's somewhere between 10 and 12. I'm going to say he's maybe 11 years old at this time. The point is, how old is Eli? We saw back in 1 Samuel 2:22 last time that already Eli was called by God an old man. And that was back at the time little Samuel was first put in his charge. He was already an old man. How old is that? I'm going to assume maybe 80 for reason. It's not important, but you're going to see why. When we get into the next chapter, we're going to see God shows that he is 98 years old when he dies. So in other words, so I'm trying to back up and put things together to say what's a potential timeline on this. It's not necessary to know, but it's somewhat of interest. But bear with me. I'm going to say that little Samuel at this age maybe was 10 or 11 years old, which means this is approximately, you know, if he's, let's say, I'm going to start with the fact that he was like 4 when he first came into Eli's household. So this is like 7 years later. No evidence for that, but see if it kind of meets a timeline. And so anyway, so Eli lays down to sleep. Eli laid down in his place and his eyes began to wax dim. This seems to indicate this was that he was already an old man, but this is now when he started slowly losing his eyesight. He could still see, but now he's starting to have his eyesight dimmed. At whatever age this was, I'm going to say approximately 7 years since Samuel was first put in his household. All right. So he's laying down and he could not see. There's a spiritual equivalent to this, because obviously Eli was blinded from a spiritual standpoint, too. His eyes were being dimmed rather than being enlightened in his orientation of mind. Verse 3, and ere the lamp of God went out in the temple of the eternal, you could say that spiritual, speaking about the, you know, the light of God spiritually going out because of apostasy, but it's really talking about a physical circumstance where the lighting of the candles, according to the procedures that were instituted in the tabernacle by God's commands, and then the candles were extinguished as the sun rose. So when the light of day came on, they would put out certain of those candles. At sunset, they would light those candles. So now we're talking about before sunrise. In essence, this is the timing. Ere the lamp of God went out in the temple of the eternal, meaning before sunrise, where the ark of God was, and Samuel was laid down to sleep. Verse 4, and the Eternal called Samuel. This is the first time now that God literally speaks to this young lad. The Eternal called Samuel, and he answered, here I am. But see, Samuel doesn't know it's God. He answered, here I am, and he ran unto Eli and said, here I am, for thou called me. He thinks, I mean, he hears this voice, and this voice is real. So again, 10 or 11-year-old boy, he hears an authoritative voice call him by name. He runs in and says, one, it tells you he's an obedient young man. He gets up immediately and runs into Eli and says, here I am. And he, meaning Eli, said, I called not. I didn't call you. Lie down again. Go back to bed. And he, Samuel, went and lay down. Verse 6, and the Eternal called yet again, Samuel. And Samuel arose and went to Eli and said, here I am. Now, I don't know, if you were Samuel, what would you think? You think Eli's calling. He called you. You go in there. He says, I didn't call you. Go back to bed. You go back to bed. Then you hear Samuel and you go back. What's this old guy doing? The Eternal called yet again Samuel, and Samuel arose and went to Eli, and he said, here I am, for thou didst call me. And he, Eli, answered, I called not, my son. Lie down again. Verse 7, and Samuel did not know yet the Eternal, Neither was the word of the Eternal yet revealed unto him. This is just, it doesn't mean that Samuel had not been instructed in the laws of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But it says he did not yet know the Eternal God in a personal relationship, because God had not actually chosen to call him, if you will, or to communicate directly with him. Now that's all changing. Verse 8, and the Eternal called Samuel again the third time. And he arose, Samuel arose, and went to Eli and said, here I am, for thou didst call me. And Eli perceived. Now after this third time, Eli perceived that the Eternal had called the child. Eli figured out what was going on. Verse 9, therefore Eli said unto Samuel, go, lie down, and it shall be, if he call you, that thou shalt say, speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth. So, you know, this is one of the things that also confirms to me that Eli was just not a profligate, hedonistic man who was, like his sons, Hophni and Phinehas, didn't care about the truth of the law. He seemed to care about important things. And so he recognized that here was the one true God was now communicating with this young boy. And he said, you need to listen to what he has to say to you. And he tells him to say, speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth. So Samuel went and lay down in his place, verse 10, and the Eternal came and stood. I think that's interesting. So in what form? Was this really the one who became Jesus Christ? Was it just an angel speaking on behalf? There are many cases in the Old Testament where it's one or the other, where God himself, the one who, God of the second part who became Jesus Christ, literally appears and speaks, like he did to Moses through the burning bush and on the top of Mount Sinai to give the law, and other times where he sends an angel who speaks in the name and by the authority of God. This seems to be a case where God himself then came into the very chamber where Samuel was sleeping, because it says he stood. I just think that's an interesting thing that God inspired. Not just that he kind of communicated to him from afar, but literally he was physically in his chamber. It doesn't say that Samuel saw anything, but he heard. And yet it says, the Lord came and stood and called, as at other times, Samuel, Samuel. Then Samuel answered. He did exactly what Eli told him to do. Samuel answered, speak, for thy servant heareth. So when God calls us, by comparison, do we respond to answer and listen to him? But here's the other thing you want to be very, very careful about. Because there's always been a tendency for people who are sincere, that have some knowledge of the truth of God, come into the church legitimately, and yet come to believe that they're a special servant who have prophetic gifts. Beware. Because it is the means by which Satan, our invisible enemy, deceives many of God's people to try to snatch the revealed truth away from you by causing you or me to think we have some elevated gift in the church and to chase after that thing which is a lie. In other words, because Satan desires to destroy you, and any new one that God brings into the church is a target. And if you are not very, very careful, you or I can fall into the trap of then buying a false voice, claiming to be the voice of God. Be very, very careful about this. I just want to show you one from 2 Corinthians 11:13, for such are false apostles, deceitful workers. If you don't think there are deceitful religious workers out there, and if you think you're too smart or too experienced or too inspired to fall for a deceiver, I would say you are in special danger. Such are false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into the apostles of Christ, representatives of Jesus Christ, who speak in his name by his authority when they are not. Verse 14, and no marvel, Paul was inspired to write to the church in Corinth, it's no wonder this stuff happens all the time, and it does. Why? For Satan himself is transformed into an angel of light. Really and truly, that's not what Paul is saying, because Satan is never an angel of light. He is an angel of darkness, and he is your enemy and my enemy, and he seeks to destroy. But he is incredibly clever, and he's incredibly adept at making himself appear and seem to be the voice of Jesus Christ for the ones who don't know how to tell the difference. Satan himself is transformed into an angel of light. Therefore, it is no great thing if his ministers, his representatives, also be transformed as the ministers of righteousness, whose end shall be according to their works. So the end result of that is never good and never will be good. And yet, how many of God's truly called people have got caught up and waylaid spiritually because they believed a false voice? A whole lot of people with true mental illness, what do you find? It used to be insane asylums. Now it's, you know, mental health facilities or whatever they want to call them. And what do? They get these grandiose ideas about having prophetic gifts or having abilities to see things, you know, or whatever. This is a common occurrence with mental illness in human beings, is ideas that they have special gifts above people around them. And I guarantee you that's the deceiver who's gotten a hold of their minds and influenced them to believe a lie. So be very, very wary. Anyway, back to 1 Samuel 3. That's not the case with Samuel. This literally is God coming into his presence and handpicking this young lad for an auspicious office that he was going to carry throughout the rest of his life. And this was the beginning of it. Carrying on in verse 11, and the Eternal said to Samuel, behold, I will do a thing in Israel. Like that wording. I don't know how it really is in Hebrew. I was like, I'm going to do a thing. But God says, I will do a thing in Israel, at which both the ears of everyone that heareth it shall tingle. So here God is telling young Samuel, I'm getting ready to do a really explosive work, and it's going to set everyone on their head when it happens. Verse 12, in that day, he says, I will perform against Eli all things which I have spoken concerning his house. When did God do this? We read that last time in the end of chapter 2, when God sent this prophet to Eli to say, you've highly displeased me by allowing your sons to run amok and mismanaging the tabernacle and therefore harming the entire nation. You didn't stop it. I'm holding you accountable. And therefore, this prophet told Eli what was going to happen. It's a pretty dire story about what was going to happen to his children. He would still have children and they would grow up and have other children, but it said all of his sons are going to die young and they're not going to be high priests anymore. The day was coming. Now, this was going to be several years down the road when they wouldn't have anything to do with the priesthood. That's going to happen during the days of David and Solomon, by the way. But this is what Eli heard from the very prophet himself. Now, God is telling young Samuel. Whether Samuel knew about that or heard it, because it doesn't say that young Samuel was anywhere around when this prophet first talked to Eli. But now God is referring to that former prophecy. For I have told him, verse 13, that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knows. Like, this is no surprise to Eli. He knows exactly what I'm talking about. Because his sons made themselves vile, and he, Eli, restrained them not. This tells you exactly why God was displeased with Eli. Not that Eli personally was engaging in a lot of personal vile misbehavior, but he was in charge, and he allowed his sons to do it, and he didn't stop them. Verse 14, and therefore, God says, I have sworn unto the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be purged with sacrifice nor offering forever. He's saying, God is telling young Samuel, I am not going to forgive Eli. Now that seems awful cruel. But remember the point. Look at all the biblical examples where God did. And what were the circumstances? Whenever an individual was what? Repentant. Whenever they, even though they were guilty of serious sins, if they acknowledged those sins and sincerely repented, God would change his sentence. So is even at this point, where Eli is not just an old man now, he's at least 7 years older. His eyesight's fading. Is it too late? Because God is pronounced. And now, you know, to Samuel, he's saying, I'm not going to forgive Eli and his house, his future children. Does that mean God wouldn't? No, because there's other examples. And I'm just going to refer you to the book of Jonah. God sending Jonah to Nineveh. And what was the message through Jonah? You all are so bad and so wicked, your sins have come to the full, and I'm going to wipe you out. And what did the Ninevites do? Surprise of all surprise, these pagans who were not Israelites, in fact, they were enemies of Israel, they acknowledged the prophecy, and they said, and they literally showed repentance in sackcloth and ashes, and asked the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to forgive them. And God, the King James says, repented, but what he did was relent. He relented, meaning he changed his sentence of death upon them because they changed. This is the same God who became Jesus Christ and is ever willing to forgive. And so I submit to you that even at this point in time, God still would have changed his state, his sentence and prognostication upon the house of Eli had Eli changed. Even this far down the line as an old man, Eli still could have acknowledged his sin and changed and started to do the things he was supposed to do. And God very likely would have relented. But what we find here, if God doesn't relent in his sentence and essence of death and curse before death, it's because the individual never repents. And the fact that this was carried out, you're going to see as we go through the rest of the books of Samuel. This absolutely came to pass. And it is proof. Eli, however, be it that he was sincere humanly, he still never got the gumption to actually respond and do what God wanted him to do. For whatever reason, he was just fatalistic about it, as you're going to see. Now compare that, just giving you a preview. Because ultimately in this series, we're going to answer the big question, what made David different so that God called King David a man after his own heart? It wasn't because David didn't do a whole lot of bad things. It was because when God brought it to his attention and called him out, David responded differently. And he absolutely showed a spirit of repentance and remorse for his sins. And the determination to take a different course. Eli never did. And that's the reason the original pronouncement upon him was never relinquished by God. All right, verse 15. Samuel lay until the morning. He's received this special message directly from God. I wonder what a young lad, 10 or 11 years old, would be thinking in his mind, especially when the first time God speaks to you, it's to confirm a pretty negative prognostication against the man who's been your guardian now for, let's say, 7 years. Samuel lay until the morning and opened the doors of the house of the Eternal, one of his assigned duties. When the sun comes up, then he was up early in order to take care of those responsibilities at the temple. And Samuel feared to show Eli the vision. He didn't want to give him the bad news. Then Eli called Samuel and said, "Samuel, my son." And he answered, Here am I. And he, Eli, said, "What is the thing that the Eternal hath said unto thee?" Eli knew God came and spoke directly to this young lad in the night. And he's saying, "What did God tell you?" "I pray thee," so even before Samuel started the hemming and the hawing, Eli says, "I pray thee, hide it not from me." Do you think Eli knew it was bad news for him? Yeah. Eli already knew, in general, the likelihood of the substance of what it was that God said to young Samuel. "Hide it not from me. God do so to thee and more also, if thou hide anything from me of all the things he has said unto thee." So did Eli already know that what God told Samuel was negative? Yeah, because he's saying, "You got to tell me the truth. Don't hide anything, or else the same thing God said is going to happen to somebody else, namely me, is going to happen to you." So he gives this young lad motivation to tell the unvarnished truth and not hold back. Verse 18, "And Samuel told him every whit and hid nothing from him. And he," Eli, "said, it is the Eternal." So Eli acknowledged this wasn't an evil spirit masquerading as God. This truly was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who appeared to you, spoke directly to you, and who prophesied to you something that is going to happen in the future. "It is the Eternal. Let him do what seemeth him good." And again, I stop here and say, here is the response of a man who's still not willing to apply himself with gumption to take this bad news and then take a different course. He's just fatalistic about it. Okay, God says, "I'm going to die, and you know, my sons are going to die, and you know, our future family is going to suffer. Okay, it's God's will." He doesn't even acknowledge that there is a way for him to change that. If he will just change his behavior, do something different than what he's been doing all these years. But Eli, David did. Eli wouldn't do it. Eli wouldn't do it. He was just failing. Okay, it really is the one true God. And he said this is what's going to happen. Okay. Let him do what seemeth him good. I can't do anything about it. Verse 19, God shows himself to Israel once again, now through Samuel. This is where now you begin to see God's specific dynamic work through young Samuel. Verse 19, and Samuel grew. So the question is now, if he was approximately 10 or 11 years old at the time this first interaction with God and this first prophecy came to him, now it says he grew. So now he's older. By how much? We don't know. But he appears now to be a young man. I would say he's minimally 20 years old, which was, if you know, by many references in the Bible, the age of accountability. I very well expect that by this time he was surpassing that age of accountability. I'm going to say he's 21. It doesn't matter, but I'm telling the story here just to kind of put these things in a little bit of a context. I'm going to say Samuel was 4 years old when his parents turned him over to Eli. 7 years later, when he was 11 years old, he had this first dynamic, prophetic communication with God. And then from 11, 10 years later, I'm going to say this is 10 years later, and he's age 21. It's not exact. It doesn't have to be, but hopefully it enriches the storyline based upon everything that's happened and the way God worked. Samuel grew and the Eternal was with him and did let none of his words fall to the ground. So remember, God called him not just to be a judge of Israel, which he would become, which means a civil magistrate in charge of the, you know, physical running of the country under God as king, but as a prophet, meaning one called by God, given the insight to see events that are going to happen and to relay messages to a target audience to tell them the future. Okay? And so here it says The Eternal was with him and did let none of his words fall to the ground. Meaning, when Samuel, young Samuel, from age 11 to 21, I'm going to say in this 10-year period, and we have no specific accounts that God chose to record for us of when and how this happened, but what we're going to see is that Samuel gained a reputation. And it was because he spoke with authority in the name of God, and then when he said something, it came to pass. Samuel earned a reputation as a true prophet of God because his prophecies came to pass. God did let none of his words fall to the ground. Turn quickly to Deuteronomy 18, verse 21 and 22, because we're answering the question, how do you know a true versus a false prophet? This is just one snippet here that tells us, Deuteronomy 18, verse 21, if thou say in thine heart, how shall we know the word which the Eternal has spoken? How can we tell if God has sent someone with authority to give us a prophecy in the name of God? How do we know he's not one of these many fakers out there? Here's the answer, verse 22. When a prophet speaks in the name of the Eternal, if the thing follow not, nor come to pass, that is the thing which the Eternal hath not spoken, but the prophet has spoken it presumptuously. Thou shalt not be afraid of him. How easy is that? Or I should say, how easy it should be. How many former worldwide ministers who have decided they have a prophetic gift and now they're going to interpret the Bible and tell us who, what, where, when, and how of the future in light of their interpretation, and then it doesn't come to pass, they get egg on their face. And then what happens? They say, I was right about the gist of it. I was just off in a couple of things. So they go back and tweak their false prophecy and regurgitate it now forward to a new timeline. And people who follow them eat this up because they demand to have a prophet. They desire so much to have somebody who tells them specifics of what's going to happen. They will listen to these fakers. They ignore the instruction of God. When his prophecy doesn't come to pass, you know God didn't send him. You better get away from that guy. We're not going to turn to Deuteronomy 13. The first part of Deuteronomy 13 adds something to it. That tells us even if a man comes along who appears to be able to do miracles, but he's telling you to embrace teachings that were not part of the original that was given to Israel, you know right there, that didn't come from God. He's a liar. And in fact, he says, those you're supposed to stone. In our day, it means reject them, don't listen to them. So twofold. One, they claim to be a prophet and their prophecies don't come to pass. You can rule them out right there. Or they seem to have some prophetic gifts or some miraculous gifts like laying on of hands, and yet they're telling you to embrace doctrines that were not part of the faith once delivered. You know right there, that is not a miracle or whatever else that's coming from the one true God. Twofold means in order to root out the fakers, if the people of God would just use them. Back to chapter 3, verse 20. And all Israel. So Samuel proved himself. I'm going to say over a 10-year period from the time God began to use him. Let's say he's a young man. I'm going to say he's 21. All Israel from Dan even to Beersheba knew that Samuel was established to be a prophet of the Eternal, because he passed the test God given. Verse 21, and the Eternal appeared again in Shiloh. I think this is an astounding statement. After all of the years when God was absent because the Israelites proved by their apostasy, they didn't really care what God said to them or to follow his instructions. So God said, fine. And he basically didn't talk to them. How many years did that go on? Now, for the first time in years, it says the Eternal appeared again in Shiloh, the city where the Ark of the Covenant, the tabernacle, was now in residence. And God, finally, for the first time, is there. For why? And how did God manifest himself there? The Eternal revealed himself to Samuel in Shiloh by the word of the Eternal. Sorry for those who resent having to hear a minister or a human being speak in the name of God, but that's the way God works. And so when God was absent, it was because there was no legitimate servant with authority who was dutifully keeping the law, let alone speaking the words of God. And now for the first time, young Samuel is that servant whom God is showing respect to. And for the first time, now God is speaking through Samuel to communicate, to commune with the entire nation. It is through a chosen servant. Chapter 4. See, we already did a whole chapter. Chapter 4, verse 1, the word of Samuel came to all Israel, because he is speaking not out of his own thoughts and his own ideas. He is speaking that which God inspires him to relay. The word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now Israel went out against the Philistines to battle. Because Samuel told him God wanted him to? No. Israel went out against the Philistines to battle and pitched beside Ebenezer, and the Philistines pitched in Aphek. I lifted one commentator summary which seemed pretty credible. This commentator said this is apparently an attack by the Philistines, meaning they started it, an incursion into Israelite territory, and Israel goes out to defend themselves. The mention of Ebenezer determines this Aphek, meaning the particular place where the Philistines set up their battle lines, to be in the south among the mountains of Judah near the western entrance of the pass of Beth Horon, and consequently on the borders of the Philistine territory. So the Philistines are apparently the aggressors in this case. They've created this battle incursion in Israelite territory. The Israelites defensively go out to meet them and to try to repel them. Verse 2, the Philistines put themselves in array against Israel, and when they joined battle, Israel was smitten before the Philistines. And they slew of the army in the field about 4,000 men. You think that's bad? Wait until you see what's coming. And when the people were come into the camp, the Israelites disheartened because they lost this battle to the Philistines, and 4,000 Israelite soldiers were killed. The elders of Israel said, "Wherefore hath the Eternal smitten us today before the Philistines? Woe is me! Where was God when we needed him?" I mean, after all, we're Israel. We're the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Our God promised he would fight our battles for us. Woe is us. God didn't deliver. What's the answer? Because they weren't seeking God's will. They were seeking to justify their own will in the name of God, as we're going to find out. There is no mention in this account that they ever asked God in advance what they should do. They presume to know what to do. Let's get our army together, rally the troops, we're going out to fight the Philistines, and God is with us. And 4,000 of them got slaughtered, and they ran back to their camps with their tails between their legs. They also then compounded it, because they didn't come back and finally seek God's will, like going to Samuel and saying, "Samuel, a proven prophet of God, what does God want us to do?" Samuel's not involved in this. They already know what they're supposed to do. Just ask them. There are a lot of experienced men. They're magistrates and leader in the nation. They're being threatened now by this foreign army. We know what we need to do. So what did these wise leaders of Israel, without God, decide to do to solve their problem? The remainder of verse 3, "Wherefore hath the Eternal smitten us today before the Philistines?" Here's our solution. "Let us fetch the ark of the covenant of the Eternal out of Shiloh unto us, that when it comes among us, it may save us out of the hand of our enemies." Oh, let's go to Shiloh and get the Ark of the Covenant and have it with our army going out in our midst, basically like a superstitious talisman, as if there is power in the box. Where is God in this? They were attributing power to this physical manifestation. Yes, God had commissioned it under Moses to be built. And there was great power manifested in God historically around it, including killing people who touched it or mishandled it. So there are supernatural things that happened around this thing called the Ark of the Covenant. But here these wise leaders of Israel just decided, all we need to be victorious and to have God on our side, we don't need to ask God through a proven prophet what he wants us to do. We already know what to do. We're going to take the ark with us out to battle this next time. And because the ark is physically in the midst of our army, we're going to have power we didn't have the first time. That's the way a pagan thinks. That's the way ungodly people think about superstitious talisman. Lucky charms. They were treating the Ark of the Covenant like a lucky charm, an absolute further abomination in their treatment of God. I would say it's akin today to people who speak about the power of prayer. I'm not going to get off on this whole thing, but most of these so-called well-meaning Christians, they're talking about the power of prayer. They're not talking about the power of God. They're talking about the power of some thing that gives them access to power of the Spirit. As if by praying in and of itself, either silently or out loud, they access power. Where is the acknowledgement that prayer is just communicating with the powerful God and all power is in his hands? Prayer is just communication, but they call it the power of prayer. It's not the power of prayer. It's the power of a God who wants you to talk to him. I will never, God helping me, use this phrase, the power of prayer, any more than these Israelites should have talked about the power of the Ark of the Covenant in their midst. That's not where power lies. God is the power. Verse 4, so the people sent to Shiloh. Oh man, they had their plan. People sent to Shiloh that they might bring from thence the Ark of the Covenant of the Eternal of Hosts, which dwells between the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. Now, these leaders of Israel come up with this plan. Well, we just need to go, you know, borrow the Ark of the Covenant to go out with us to battle. Where was Eli? Where were Hophni and Phinehas saying, this is not of God, don't do this, we won't permit it? Because they were the ones in charge of the tabernacle, including the ark within it. Eli has checked out. He still turned it over to his wayward sons. He's not intervening. And Hophni and Phinehas are all on board with this plan. So they didn't stop the bad idea. In fact, they championed it because Hophni and Phinehas, as we're going to see, go out with the army, with the ark. Verse 5, and when the ark of the covenant of the eternal came into the camp, so they bring it out of Shiloh to wherever the army of Israel was. The ark of the covenant of the eternal came into the camp. All Israel shouted with a great shout so that the earth rang again. Oh, they're excited now. They're ready for a big victory because the ark is here. And when the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, what meaneth the noise of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews? And they, the Philistines, understood that the ark of the eternal was come into the camp. How did the Philistines react to this? They knew about this ark too. The Philistines, verse 7, were afraid. Why? Because the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and this Ark of the Covenant had a history, and they knew it well. The Philistines were afraid, for they said, God, meaning the Hebrews' God, is come into the camp. And they said, woe unto us, for there hath not been such a thing heretofore. We have never experienced the idea where the Israelites bring that ark out in onto the battlefield. Woe unto us, who shall deliver us out of the hand of these mighty gods? And it's capital G, and I wondered, did the Philistines really acknowledge that there were more than one being called God, as we understand God as a family, or this is probably just their paganism because they worship many gods and they're attributing that to Israel as well. Regardless, who shall deliver us out of the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods that smote the Egyptians with all the plagues in the wilderness. Hundreds of years before, and the stories had passed down generation to generation among all of these ones who lived in the land of Canaan, former land of Canaan, that was Israel. And they were respectful of it because they knew what happened in the destruction of the Egypt, in the entire Egyptian military and that society in the day, and the exploits of the nation of Israel under Moses and then Joshua that came in and became dominant in that land. Verse 9, but somebody, it doesn't say who or how, in other times when God intervenes, one of his methods to defeat a foreign enemy is to demoralize that enemy through supernatural means. Did God do that here? No. So here, but the Philistines, their natural reaction is to be afraid and superstitious and worry. They're going to lose. What could have happened? If God was behind this, he could have exploited that natural fear and caused them to turn tail and run. But someone in the Philistine camp instead says, verse 9, be strong and quit yourselves like men, O you Philistines. Someone came up and steeled their resolve against their fear and said, don't let this affect you, this great cheering that you hear coming in the enemy camp over there because they've brought this powerful talisman into their midst. We're strong. We can still beat them. Be strong and quit yourselves like men, O you Philistines, that you be not servants of the Hebrews. It says, don't let them prevail, because then, instead of us being the dominant ones, they will then overrun us. That you be not servants unto the Hebrews as they have been to you. So up to this time, the Philistines, again, historically, were holding the upper hand. Quit yourselves like men and fight. And guess what? They did. Verse 10, and the Philistines fought, and Israel was smitten. Again, they lost. The first time they lost 4,000 soldiers. What about this time? The Philistines fought, and Israel was smitten, and they fled every man into his tent, and there was a very great slaughter, for there fell of Israel 30,000 footmen. 30,000 deaths in the camp of Israel. I can't even imagine what that number would be like to see that many bodies dead on the battlefield. Verse 11, what's more, the ark of God was taken. They lost the ark to the enemy. The ark of God was taken, and what else happened? The two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were slain. So it was a triple curse which took place. 30,000 Israelites killed, the Ark of the Covenant taken by the Philistines, and the two sons of the high priest were slaughtered on the battlefield as well. Verse 12, and there ran a man of Benjamin out of the army and came to Shiloh the same day with his clothes rent and the earth upon his head. And when he came, lo, Eli sat upon a seat by the wayside watching. And I'm wondering if this is like the same seat, which was a mark of his office as a judge of Israel, the same one that back in chapter 1, he was sitting on outside the tabernacle when Hannah first came and was praying. And when he talked to her, I wonder if it was the same one. It says he's by the wayside. When he came, lo, Eli sat upon a seat by the wayside watching, for his heart trembled for the ark of God. Even more so than worrying about his sons, he truly was afraid for what would happen to the Ark of the Covenant. Well, then where was he? Why didn't he prevent it going out from the beginning? So he cared about important things. He cared about godly things, but he was a weak man. and he was not willing or able at the time to follow through to actually fulfill his God-given office. God gave him the authority, and he wouldn't do it. His heart trembled for the ark of God, and when the man came into the city and told him, all the city cried out. So they hear it, the ones the man is proclaiming the result of this battle as he's coming into the city before he gets to Eli. Verse 14, and when Eli heard the noise of the crying, he said, what meaneth the noise of this tumult? And the man came in hastily and told Eli. Now Eli was 98 years old. Here's the reference I had from the beginning. He was an old man, as chapter 2 told us, and doesn't tell us how old is old. Just for argument's sake, I'm going to say 80. If then, let's say that was at the time when little Samuel was 4 years old, 7 years later when Samuel was 11, he would have been 88. 10 years later, Samuel would have been 21 years old, coming to his full, now as a prophet of God, which would put Eli at this time at 98. How do you like that for math? It's just speculation, but it's one potential scenario that would kind of fit with all of these pieces. Eli was 98 years old and his eyes were dim. About 17, 18 years earlier, or 10 years early, I'm going to say, when Samuel first had his first communion with God, when it said Samuel's eyes were starting to be dim. Now, 10 years later, for instance, now he's virtually blind. Eli was 98 years old and his eyes were dim that he could not see. And the man said unto Eli, I am he that came out of the army and I fled today out of the army. And he said, what is there done, my son? Verse 17, and the messenger answered and said, Israel is fled before the Philistines, and there hath been also a great slaughter among the people, and thy two sons also, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the ark of God is taken. Verse 18, and it came to pass when he made mention of the ark of God, which seemed to be the thing that Eli cared most about, to his credit, when he, this messenger, made mention of the ark of God, that he, Eli, fell from off the seat backward by the side of the gate, and his neck brake, and he died, for he was an old man and heavy. So the weight of his own body falling backward caused his neck to break. And he, Eli, had judged Israel 40 years. So it was God's appointment, the time of Eli in the office of high priest. God sets them up. God takes them down. Eli completed 40 years in that office, even though he totally mismanaged it. And now he dies. I also think about the thing we were always taught is in the Bible. When a servant of God is affected, when God inspires them in a miraculous way, the servants of God fall forward. When the servants who are inspired by that alternative spirit, they fall backward. And so I remember Mr. Armstrong speaking about that concerning these Pentecostals and this charismatic movements with people who are slain in the spirit and they're whatever. And what do? They fall backward. Kind of one of those physical anomalies which indicates the spirit of Satan rather than the spirit of God. God's faithful servants fall forward. Eli fell backward. Not saying, but we know where God, had him in his judgment. And so now, after 40 years, he falls backward and breaks his neck. The proof of this story, after all of those years when it appeared God was doing nothing, because the days were dark, and as the reference in the very last verse in the book of Judges says, in those days, every man was doing that which was right in his own eyes. And even through the whole time that Eli was in this office of high priest, it was a time of apostasy. They had a semblance of respect for the law, and they had the tabernacle, and they had the Ark of the Covenant, and they were going through the motions concerning the offerings and the sacrifices, but not according to the instruction of God, and God held them accountable, which is why he didn't talk with them, he didn't inspire them, and he certainly didn't help them It was a dark, dark period. And now you have the culmination of a very dark period. A fourfold curse that God unleashes upon his own people. 30,000 Israelites die in battle. Hophni and Phinehas and Eli all die. I'm putting Eli separate. That's 2 and 3. And then worst of all, the Ark of the Covenant was lost to the enemy. All right, that's our stopping point. Next time then, we're going to continue with the end of chapter 4, which is references the widow of one of Eli's sons giving birth right when this all happens, and then into chapter 5 beyond. We'll do that next time.
The Church of God the Eternal has just presented the fifth message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, March 8th, 2025. Thank you.